Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, October 6, 2024. My name is Melanie C., a recovered compulsive overeater from Canby, Oregon. The share ID numbers for Friday, October 4, 2024 are the following. The 7 a.m. Eastern Time Big Book Study share ID number is 21802. And the 10 a.m. Eastern Time Big Book Study share ID number is 21803. This morning, A Vision for You presents Leading to Transformation by God's Mercy. Transformation through God's mercy, as experienced by our guest speaker, reflects the profound change that comes from engaging deeply with both a higher power and the 12-step process here of recovery. This transformation is rooted in surrender, humility, and grace, as the 12-step serves as a structured pathway to spiritual renewal. Pardon me. The first few steps of the 12-step process center on admitting powerlessness over compulsive overeating and destructive behaviors, recognizing the need for divine intervention. As it is for many, this might have been the critical moment where one realized that self-reliance was not enough and that God's mercy was the only way forward. This kind of surrender allows to receive God's grace, which begins the transformation. The steps of taking a moral inventory and confessing our wrongs, steps 4 and 5, are a powerful act of humility. For many, this process brings a sense of freedom and release as they unburden themselves from guilt and shame. Transformation involves this profound house cleaning effort for healing, enabling each the acceptance of self as loved by God, despite past mistakes. In this act of honesty, God's mercy shines through, offering forgiveness and renewal. Steps 8 and 9 involve making direct amends with those harmed, which can be daunting, but the healing process. Our guest speaker will undoubtedly describe how this process helped restore broken relationships and feel the mercy of God as the past was cleaned up by the step work to heal the past. The humility and courage required for this step often lead to deeper spiritual transformation, where God's mercy becomes evident through reconciliation and restored peace. In the latter steps, the focus shifts to maintaining spiritual growth and service to others. This transformation is ongoing, marked by continued reliance on God's mercy and sharing the message of recovery. The speaker may share how this life of service and surrender has not only transformed the inner life, but also their external relationships and overall purpose. The concept of God's mercy, quote unquote, in this context is about unconditional love, forgiveness, and restoration. The speaker's journey through the 12 steps allow to not only break free from addiction or compulsive behaviors, but to also experience a deeper relationship with power, which is God, one that is compassionate and transformative. This message of transformation speaks to the power of the 12 steps as a spiritual discipline that aligns the individual with God's mercy, leading to healing and a renewed sense of purpose. It is with a great pleasure that I introduce our guest speaker this morning. In the spirit of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, her story is the essence of the promises outlined in the Big Book of AA. It's sheer inspiration, hope, and the transformation of power of recovery. Her journey, like many of ours, has been one of trials and triumphs, setbacks and successes. From the depths of despair and the shackles of addiction, she has emerged recovered, a testament to the promise of redemption that lies within each one of us. This morning, she will share with us her personal odyssey. Her story is not just one of survival, but of thriving, not just of overcoming, but transcending. As we listen to her words, may we find the solace in the knowledge that we are not alone, that there is a path to abstinence and God's mercy, and that recovery is not just a possibility, but a promise. Let us open our hearts and our minds to receive the wisdom and grace that she so generously offers here this morning. Please join me in welcoming our guest speaker today, and all the way from South Carolina, welcome Anne-Marie M.
Melanie, thank you so much for the introduction. Thank you for all of your service, and you have been especially helpful to me, especially in my early work in this program. So thank you, and thank you for waking up so early. I appreciate it. Thank you. My name is Anne Marie M. I am a recovered compulsive overeater through God's grace and by working the steps in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I usually introduce myself when I speak on the line. And I do that, one, because I need to remember that I'm recovered through God's grace. I did a lot of the work. God removed me. And I need to remember that it's God's grace and not me, because I have an ego. And also, through reading the steps in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried many other ways, besides hypnotists and self-help books and, even OA literature. I know OA literature is very good, and it didn't help me. I did a lot of workbooks, spent a lot of time, but it was really the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that led me to the solution, is a relationship with God. And I keep working in the Big Book by, taking sponsors through it, because I need to remember that relationship with God is number one in my life. It is number one in my life, and I need to remember that I need to keep working at it. It's not a one-and-done deal. And, God's got the words. I mean, he's got the message. He's using my voice, I believe. I trust that. And so here we go. So the title, Persevering, Leading to Transformation by God's Mercy, I wanted to stress how much I persevere in this program of OA. I came to my first meeting in 1988. I got sober in 1985, heard about OA. I heard of that someone lost a lot of weight in a program called Overeaters Anonymous, and I thought, well, I'm going to join that. And since that time, the first 20 years, I just did not believe when someone had said that sugar was like a drug. And I thought, oh my gosh, these people are Looney Tunes. Like, I think they're just a little bit over the top if they're thinking that, I want to use sugar as a drug. The first 20 years I was in and out. And actually, I think like from 1992 to 2008, probably, I was mostly out of OA. I had gone to a couple of meetings. I found a new higher power, and it was my second husband, and that didn't work out. Let me just tell you that. So I just kept on working. So from 2008 today, I worked the steps. I had the best sponsors. I had the best help. I went through the Big Book. I did whatever my sponsor told me to do. I persevered. I kept on going. And I did look up the definition: perseverance, steady persistence in a course of action, a purpose, especially by difficulties, obstacles, and or discouragement. So that's why I chose the word persevering, and then, leading to transformation. And I've had it's not just a one and done deal. Of transforming my body, but my whole being has been transformed. And transformation, I looked that word up, and to change in condition, nature, or character. And the transformation through doing the work in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous came through to me by my higher power. And I'm forever grateful for that, forever grateful. And then, so I needed to keep this topic, title to, so many words, I think, or just, I needed to have it concise. So I really want to say, persevering. Leading to transformation by, I want to say, God's grace and mercy. So I thought, oh my gosh, which one should I pick? Grace or mercy? So it has been God's grace and God's God's mercy, and I usually say, you know, through God's grace, and which is a definition that I found, the free and unmerited favor of God, you know, a divinely given talent. God gave this to me. I didn't have to earn it. Oh my gosh, all the years I tried so hard to please God, to do this, to do that, and God loves me so much. You know, I didn't have to do all of that. And I chose mercy, compassionate treatment, because my God is so compassionate to me. So forgiveness by someone who has the power to punish. And through all the heartache I've caused my family growing up, oh gosh, with my drinking and compulsive overeating, and you know, of my mother, the heartache that I caused her. And so you know, God hasn't punished me. You know, I'm not in, you know, I'm no longer in chains of the disease. With all of that said, I'll just begin with, I believe I was born a compulsive overeater. My earliest memories when I was about 4 or 5 and being at a birthday party, I have a big family. I'm originally from Rhode Island, my home, and love my friends in Rhode Island and my family. But I came from a big family, and we would have a birthday party. Actually, every Sunday, we get together, and on birthday parties, you know, it didn't really matter. We'd have a big dinner and then desserts and everything. And the kids always want, you know, my cousins, I have 18 cousins, I guess me included, 18 all of us. Anyway, they wanted to go out and play Red Rover, and all those games that we used to play outside. And they would leave the desserts behind and run outside. And I kind of wanted to just cuddle in my mom's lap and some of her dessert and just hang around with the adults while they had coffee and dessert. And I just couldn't bear to leave. Behind. My first compulsive eating, I remember when I was around 8 years old, and I was in the house, and my mother had just gone off to the hairdresser. My brothers and father was out doing the lawn, and that's how it was. The women took care of the inside of the house, the men took care of the outside, and I was home alone doing some housework, and I just felt uneasy. And I remembered there were some cookies in the cupboard, and I went and bought a couple, and I ate it. And, you know, I don't remember the taste of it, but I remember the comfort I felt, and I wanted more of that. And I have chased that comfort ever since that day. I rearranged, so I kept on going back, and I rearranged the sleeves, and even opened up the other sleeve and put some of those cookies in the other sleeve so that it didn't look like it had been touched that much. So I felt shame that shame came very early on in my recovery with my compulsive eating. And so from then on, I knew where to get my comfort. Now, I was brought up in a religious household, went to church Sunday, but I didn't get the comfort from God that I believe now. Because I had already found comfort in the higher power food, you know, in sugar in particular. So I went on, and but then in high school I found alcohol, and like I mentioned, I'm alcoholic as well. And one speaker I hear say that he was fat, and then he was an alcoholic, and then he was a fat alcoholic, and I can relate to that because I thought that once I started drinking, then I would, you know, get skinny. And I went on a weight loss program. I became a lifetime member at the age of 17. I was very proud of that. And So I was probably about 30 pounds overweight in my sophomore year of high school. And within a year, I got down to a weight, and I got so many compliments from teachers, from my parents, of how good I looked. And that's what I strive for the rest of my life. You know, in the big book, and where Bill said, I had arrived, you know, I thought I had arrived. I didn't care so much. Like, Bill strived for the money and the prestige. I just strive for the size 2 jeans. I'm only 5 feet tall, so size 2 jeans, what I strive for. And I believed with all my heart that if I got into that size, then I would be smart. Like me, I would eat in everything I did. And, you know, it didn't last. Like with Bill, you know, he got all that money and prestige, and drinking took him away. And for me, the compulsive overeating took me away. Moving on, I quit drinking when I found out I was pregnant at the age of 26. And I compulsively, and, you know, I didn't stop compulsively eating when I was drinking. That was not a cure for me. So I still compulsively overate. And people wondered, like, I would go out with the kids afterwards after a basketball game, and we'd go to McDonald's, and I'd have a tab, and which is a Diet Coke. And yeah, Marie, how do you gain? Because I would gain weight, you know, I'd be compulsively overeating. And I don't know how you gain weight, you know, because all you eat is salads, and we didn't have salads back then at McDonald's, but tab, and, you know, just, oh, you're always dieting. And it was like my secret. So I had told you already that I went into my first OA meeting. I did not hear anything about the big book. I'm not saying that the big book wasn't there. I did not see the big book. It wasn't there at the first meetings that I went to. And so I did, you know, what I was told to do. But I was defiant in some ways, like with the sugar. Surely, now, come on, sugar could not be addictive. I mean, it's a food. And when I was on that weight loss program, I ate it several times. I controlled it for a while, and I was able to control it for a while. But I've also been told that this is progressive disease. And this is rest where I was no longer able to control. So I went into, so this was probably in the early 2000s, like 2007, 2008, and went into Barnes & Noble with a huge bag of M&Ms. And as a friend says, it wasn't plain M&Ms, it was a peanut M&Ms. Wasn't going to jump myself out of that. But anyway, went to Barnes & Noble with two huge bags, found a chair, put my stuff down, and then looked in the aisle where all the how to lose weight, what to do, you know, all the books on how I could figure out how I was going to accomplish stopping. Because I knew about OA already, and I brushed that off. It didn't work. And I found a book that was written by a doctor and by a compulsive overeater that explained that sugar is just as addictive as cocaine, that it hits the same spots in the brain. I'm being very generic, but it was so eye-opening to me. And I thought, my gosh, I guess sugar is a drug. I mean, this was written by a doctor and a compulsive overeater. So they knew what they were talking about. They had facts that there was, and there was other foods too that they mentioned in the book, besides sugar, flour, white flour, and even caffeine, and just some other substances that hit the same spots of the brain that cocaine hits. And so I thought, okay, well, I am just going to stop eating sugar, and I did. And I stopped eating anything that had sugar in it. And so I lost weight. I fought with weight like 40 pounds most of my life. My highest, I'm 5 feet now. I was at one time 5'2", but I'm 5 feet now. But at my highest weight was 185. So I was kind of round. But at this time, I was, 30, 40 pounds over. And so I lost my train of thought. I went to, So I stopped eating anything that had sugar in it. And I lost weight. Within a couple of months, weight was gone. Again, I had arrived. How about that? I had arrived again. And but I still didn't feel, I thought that my inner feelings were going to feel something special when I got down to that weight. And it just never did. It never did. So I ate, I started, the compulsive eating did not go away. I was able to control while and not eat the sugar, but I compulsively on carrots and on rice cakes and on celery sticks, anything that didn't have sugar. And then I realized, you know what? Potato chips don't have sugar in it. And so I started compulsively eating that and dried air popcorn. Oh my gosh, I don't know how much of that I ate. So, and then I started eating sugar-free stuff, which they're not sugar-free. Have stevia and it, and so I started eating that stuff, and I started gaining. And I thought I need to go back to OA again. I was going to OA to beginning, so I went back to OA, and I got a sponsor, and she told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I thought that would be impossible. And she told me to go online and look for a meeting, and I found a meeting that talked about the Big Book. Now, I was familiar with the Big Book because I'm in AA. I didn't go into AA. I'm still involved in AA. But anyway, so I said, well, I'm going to go to that meeting. And I learned so much. And this is my experience. At this point, I was probably 20 or 22 years. I figured out the math once ago, a while ago. But anyway, I was quite – I learned more about the Big Book in this OA meeting than I – ever learned in AA, because my sponsor, when I, back in 88, when I got, I got sober, took me through 12 and 12 steps, and I did great. I stopped drinking, and I did what my sponsor did, and I became service-oriented and all that stuff, but I didn't realize that the Big Book was a roadmap of how to live life, of how to deal with my emotions. Because I quit drinking, yes, but I continued compulsively eating when emotions came up. So I learned a lot. However, that particular did not emphasize allergy of the body. Now, it wasn't too much long ago, earlier, that I had read that book written by a doctor that had facts that sugar was addictive. But in this particular they believe. And that as long as I have a God, then I'd be able to do anything I want. And so, hey, they didn't have to twist my arm too much. And I started compulsively. That was probably in 2009 at this point. And from 2009 till about 2012, I couldn't stop compulsively. It was bad. And anyway, long story short, a vision for you began. I got the best of the best sponsors. All of my sponsors at every time was always the best of the best. And I love every one of my sponsors. Anyway, we came into a vision for you together. I was recovered by the end of 2012. And I had arrived again, And so I got recovered. I started sponsoring. My ego flared more than it ever had flared. And I thought I had to save. I had three women that I was sponsoring. And I put aside time in the morning because these women needed, and they all worked, and they needed me first thing. So I thought, you know what? Well, I'll spend my time with God. And I spent time with God at that time because that's what I was told to do. In order to stay abstinent, I needed to stay connected to God. And that was a condition that I had on God. Okay, God, I'm spending time with you. keep me abstinent. Well, anyway, that went out the window. And I didn't do 10 steps at that time because I had been recovered. I had the title, you know, the title, recovered. You know, I wasn't going to call my sponsor or tell anybody that I was feeling uneasy. You know, I could deal with it myself. And so self-reliance, you know, it talks about that on page 2 of it was total self-reliance. I know it talks about that in when we do the fourth step and inventory, you know, fear for me is fear really isn't the character defect. I think that self-reliance is a character defect which leads me to fear. And that's the bottom line for me of all my troubles, not having reliance on God. So I digressed a little bit from where I was at. And so anyway, between 2012 and 2013, believe it or not, I got recovered another 2 times. And like the amnesia I have with that I don't remember what it was like, I had the amnesia with my recovered state that I needed to continue doing the work. And in 2015, I went out for 5 years, and I could not stop. And I thought it was bad when I went back out in 2009. But this was, it just kept on getting worse and worse. And I had so many people asking for help, begging for help. I did not want to compulsively overeat. I did not want to put the food in my mouth. Like, I remember stuffing food in my mouth thinking, why am I doing this? You know, why? Oh, my gosh. Anyway, a friend of mine, this is October of 2020, and she begged me to go to this workshop. And I went to the workshop, and they were talking about the Big Book. And this person was talking about all that she knew about the Big Book. And I thought, I know the Big Book. I mean, how arrogant can I be? I mean, this woman had years and years of abstinence and was clearly knowledgeable of the Big Book, and I'll ever be at this point. And I thought, no, I don't need this. And it got worse. Can you believe that? Yes, it got worse. November and the beginning of December of 2020, I didn't want to wake up. I remember driving home from work, saying to myself, and I've said this on meetings, but I don't know if I'm being repetitive, but I would drive home to work with my hands on the wheels and saying to myself, now it's maybe 10 minutes at the most for me to get from me when I would work from my workplace to my home. And I would say, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop. And then the wheel turned, and I was in, before you know it, I'm up and down the aisles of the convenience store. What was going to fix me? Had no idea that turmoil that was going on within myself, but I just wanted some comfort. And I remember when I was a little girl and I had the first couple of cookies, I wanted that comfort back. And I've never been able to obtain it through the food. Through God's grace, God's mercy, through my relationship with Him, yes, I have comfort. I have ease and comfort from this. So I got a sponsor, and I did whatever she told me to do. And she gave me disciplines that I continue to use today, and I followed them because I was desperate. And it was actually December 31st is the first day that I had abstinence, and I've kept that abstinence since then of 2020. And I remember calling her on the 30th and saying that I compulsively, and I wish I remembered what she said, but she scared me. She wasn't a scary person, but what she said, I trust and believe God, and I thought, I can't compulsively eat anymore. And I started doing what I call, and what was called two-way prayer. And I developed an awesome relationship with God, and it continues to grow and grow. And that's been the big difference in all of my, because when back from 2015 to 2020, I'd get 3 months sometimes of abstinence. I'd be abstinent from compulsive eating for a couple of days. You know, I was abstained from eating any sugar or any flour for a couple of days or a couple of the most of all these years, from 1988, December of 2020, the most I ever got was 10 months of being abstinent from compulsive eating. And I struggled. And I know so many people get on the line and talk about how they have many, many years, you know, that they've come into this program for many years. I know that I say that. I say that with the hope that those that are just starting off learn from my mistakes, learn that self-reliance doesn't work, learn that the steps in the big book, which I believe finally written, if you ever hear the history, the special editions, and you can call me and I can tell you which ones to follow. This, we have a wonderful historian who brings the big book alive. And once you start hearing about the history of this big book, I don't know how you can deny that a God did not put this together, this whole program together. But I don't, I know I can't deny it. So I got busy and I started doing whatever she told me to do. And the transformations started. In the doctor's opinion, and in Bill's story, and also on page 568, it talks about the essentials. And I'm going to do my best. I really procrastinated about looking stuff up. And so I haven't finished, so maybe I'll finish another time looking stuff up in the big book. But the essentials on, in the doctor's opinion, on Roman numeral 29, which is XXIV. Oh, here it is. One feels, so this is a doctor writing, a medical doctor. One feels that something more than human power is needed in to produce the essential psychic change. And what I learned with the essentials in the appendix 2, it says the last paragraph on page, besides the quote, on page 568 says, we find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. Essentials of recovery. But these are indispensable. And then the other one that I found was in Bill's story. And that was on page 13. I love page 13 and 14 of Bill's story. And here it is, right at the bottom of the page, the last sentence, belief in power, in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. So willingness, honesty, humility, open-mindedness. Believe it or not, I have those things today. There's one transformation because when I came in and my very first sponsor told me, you know, something like, get a dietitian. And I thought to myself, I didn't say this to her, of course, but why would I pay a dietitian or a nutritionist when I know so much? I mean, at 17, I was a lifetime member of a great diet program. Why would I, you know, I remember listening to a recording of someone saying that had years of, once again, had years of of abstinence, of recovery, a wonderful recovered woman, saying that she couldn't drink diet. And I thought, well, I can drink diet soda without a problem. You know, that doesn't bother me. I mean, the cockiness has left. There's a transformation. There's a transformation for me. And I'm just so grateful. Another open-mindedness, when I did a 10th step with someone and I started going on and on, and so she so lovingly said to me, Anne Marie, you're telling me a story. And tell me, I don't need to hear the story. Continue on with the story, then I'm going to end up siding with you. I'm not going to be able to. And I took that. I didn't get off the phone angry. I thought, oh my gosh, thank you for being so honest with me. Oh my gosh, you know, there's a transformation. Because I remember the time I got dropped, I got fired by a sponsor, and I was so angry at her, and I called so many people. I mean, there was no 10th step in this at all. I called so many people telling them, you know, how could she do this to me? And there I am being corrected on how to do a 10th step and being appreciative, you know, the openness of being able to be corrective. There's a transformation. In step one, in the doctor's opinion, this is an important paragraph to me. It's not the doctor talking, but it's, I guess, the pundit that wrote the book. It says, it says here, in this statement, confirms the physician, talking about the physician, confirms that we who had suffered alcoholic torture must believe. And I was told there were no musts in the big book. I have them all outlined in orange, all the musts and have tos in the big book. Anyway, in this statement, the doctor confirms we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Okay? And the last sentence, belief, any picture of the alcoholic, which leaves this physical factor, in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic without this physical factor is incomplete. Well, my idea that sugar wasn't a drug, you know, it says it right here that we have, you know, when each goes on, talk about the allergies. And so, wow, you know, I guess he's right. And let's see what else. In the doctor's opinion, the last paragraph on Roman numeral 28, XXVII. Oh, yeah, men and women drink. Essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, some of the foods that I ate, I couldn't even stand the taste of. I mean, you know, when I took food out of the garbage, when I ate food from the freezer that was still frozen and I didn't want to take time for it to defrost. I don't know if anybody can relate, but that's what I was like. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, and believe me, I knew it was injurious. I knew that I was ruining my health. I knew, but I couldn't stop. They cannot, after a time, differentiate true from the false. So this, all that I just said wasn't all in the video. A lot of that was ad lib. Anyway, to them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I did. I thought that, you know, when I'm feeling upset, pop something in my mouth. I mean, that I thought was normal. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can experience the ease and comfort which comes from at once taking a few drinks. And for me, it really was vice. But it never was a few bites. The whole container. It was a whole package. And so after a while, I take that bite, I succumb to the desire again. And once I took that bite, believe it or not, I had to admit the allergy kicked in and I couldn't stop. And I would say, okay, Okay, I will not do this again. Monday's coming up. I'm going to stop on Monday. That didn't happen for me. This is repeated over and over unless the person can experience an entire psychic change. Unless he can experience that psychic change, there is very little hope of this recovery. Talks about the transformation somewhere. I had written that on page 27. Oops, I lost tag. Let me see here. 27. I think it's from 27. Yes. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the life of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions, motives, and motives begin to dominate them. What a promise. And that's in There Is a Solution. And what I was taught in the big book, that the first four chapters, including the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, There Is a Solution, and more about alcoholism, are all on step one. And they have we agnostics as step two, and then how it works, step three and four, and then so on and so forth. But anyway, so there's a lot on step one in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I needed that because, I needed to have that a transformation. And I believe that one sentence, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of their lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. Nowhere in here does it say they cast it to one side. Because I know I didn't do it. I didn't do it. A completely new set of conceptions and motives began to dominate them. My motive today is to do God's will. Believe me, that is a transformation. When I first came in, recovery period, 12 steps, I came in looking, told me I was going to get help. So that's what I came in looking for. I came in looking for help. Then I learned how to do service. An AA, but when the food got so bad, I came crawling into the doors of OVS Anonymous, looking and seeking for help. I had no thought of helping somebody else, not an inkling of how if I could do something for somebody else. I just wanted somebody to help me. I remember writing a mass email to as many of, this is really early on, when probably between 2015 and 2020, that I wrote a mass email to somebody, help me. So I digress again. So that the doctor's and then Bill's story, I had mentioned that I had arrived. When I first read the story, I said, how am I going to relate to this guy? A businessman, not business oriented at all, and out after money. I could care less about money. I wanted a thin body, but you know what? I related to him. He wanted money. I wanted a thin body. Those were still, the money, the prestige, thin body, the look. That was my idol. So we both had idols that didn't work. That's how I related. And I think I told you about there is a solution. There's so much. I just pick up things. And then more about alcoholism. I love this is like my favorite chapter because I relate so much to him and the jaywalker. Those two I relate most. And Jim on page 36. It says that, on page 35, it says that, he didn't enlarge on his spiritual life. But then, they said, these guys in AA, they didn't give up on him. They didn't say, you got drunk, go get sober and come back to me when you're sober. They said, let's go over, what you did. And he did that with Fred, too, guys in AA. Let's go over what happened. So he says here on page 36, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. So I don't know if someone's not familiar with the big book or this particular story. Jim owned this car dealership, and he got drunk and he lost it, and then got his job back, but he no longer owned it, and he had to be the employee. The employer. He had to become the employee where he used to be boss. So anyway, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. This is a sentence that I identify with. I had a few words, but nothing serious. Well, talk about self-reliance. I don't know how many times I would leave work not even knowing that I was upset because I didn't know my feelings. I didn't know my emotions because I ate all the time. But after doing this work, I realized all the times that I left work, how angry I was, how upset, how fearful. I thought was going to cover all that up, but there was never enough food. Never enough. So that is, just a jaywalker doing it over and over and over again, and getting the adrenaline rush. I would get an adrenaline rush from sneaking around. And my husband remembers this story. I think before the story happened, he would think I was just a lot of vanity. I just wanted to lose some weight. He always loved me no matter what size I am or was, whatever. But he had gone shopping. And we had bought ice cream, put it in the freezer, got his sweets. Still has a cupboard with his sweets in it. But he always, I think almost every night, he has a small dish of ice cream. And so but he always has it at night. But for some reason, we went out shopping in the morning, and he went to go for golf and eat ice cream and all the stuff that we. And I was about to leave the house, go replace it. I think this is the adrenaline rush, I think, like for the jaywalker. You know, when he tried to get across the street. I opened the freezer. What in the world are you doing? And I'm like, in memory, we have ice cream. And I felt the blood, just drop from my face. My heart was in my stomach, and I very quietly said, I ate it. And he said, looking at me like I had two heads, said, you ate all of it? I said, yeah. And I ate the cookies. And he just looked like he was in shock. And he said, how did you not get sick? Like nauseous. And I looked at him like he had two heads. Like, what do you mean? I do this all the time. I'm thinking to myself, like, why would I get sick? I do this stuff all the time. It's like I eat mounds and mounds of food. And it was from then on he realized that this is real sickness. And so I've had his support, and I'm so grateful. God has really blessed me. He has blessed me. More about alcoholism and then how it works. In step three, on page 62, it says, that second full paragraph. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. I was like, really? Like, I'm the victim here. I'm the victim who can't stop compulsively. Like, why? I didn't understand that. But I've come to learn that I set the ball rolling. It talks about that in the fourth step. But anyway, I'm the one who set the ball rolling. And self-reliant. You know, I was self-reliant. And that's where it comes. So troubles, this is from the book. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme. extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. That was me. And there's another transformation. My gosh, I'm running out of time. There's another transformation. Like, I know now. I went through the steps. I know what my character defects are. I see them. They're like, ding, ding. You know, when something comes out of my mouth and it's like, shouldn't have said that. I know now. Ask God to remove it. Stop me from continuing with this comment that I've already blurted out. And I know that I need to do a 10-step and 10-step continue to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. And I know to promptly admit it now, which I didn't know before. I just, that was my like a transformation. I just looked to the other person and I remember this one time. I can't remember the exact. Isn't that something? I was so angry. And I can't remember it now, but something with my daughter. Yeah, she talked to me like that. Oh, my gosh. I kept my mouth shut, but I said, I'm going to hang up now, and I hung up. So after doing a 10-step, I realized that I owed her an amends. I wanted to look so much at what she had said to me because it was blatant, obviously, that she owed me an amends. And so I felt better after I got off the phone, and she personally suggested I do a 10-step. And I said, well, I do an amends, and I thought, well, I'll pray on that one. And this conversation in my head that I can't remember now went on for a while, and then I needed to do another 10-step because it was occupying my mind. I can't remember where that page is. I do remember it's on page 66. But it kept on going over and over. It's a snowball effect. And so I did another 10-step, and I was another transformation. I saw that what my part was in it. I hung up the phone abruptly on her. She deserved that? No. There's a transformation. At the beginning of the conversation, at the beginning of the 10th step, I was positive she deserved that. That works so good in my life. I swear. Oh, my gosh. On page 66, this is part of the 4th step, but we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Prepare to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state of mind, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or freed, had the power to actually kill. Because if I continued on that, I think I may have gone back to the food, get that comfort, or seek that comfort, or the delusion that I was going to get comfort from food. So I didn't even have that in my notes. I think for me, the most important part of the 4th step, prayer. And it says it in somewhere in step 2, in the agnostics, that God, with all these people in this book, that God has become the most, their relationship with God is most important, and it is with me today. It's with me today. And so I think the thesis of the book is for us to get a relationship with God. And so in the 4th step, I must rely on God with prayer. Before going from the 3rd column to the 4th column, I need to pray and ask God, not pray for the other person. I used to pray for the other person, but to pray that God removes the character, change me. And that's on page 67. A lot of people call it the sick man's prayer, and I think I'm the one who's sick now. I realize I'm the one who's sick. So it says here, one of the many prayers in this book, there's so many prayers, so many promises. We ask God to help us, okay, to help me. If I personalize it, I ask God to help me. God, help me. I'm not asking God to change them because I really, really, really thought that was going to be the answer. If they change, I'd be happy. we ask God to help me. I ask God to help me show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I learned from my sponsor what tolerance means, and it means, I thought it meant I had to put up with somebody else's behavior. And I can never quote exactly what she says, but tolerance, but from what I understand, it helps me, allows me to roll things off my back, allows me to not be so upset with what other people are doing. And on page 88, excuse me, there's a prayer on the top of page 88, I will be done. There's a promise here. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily. You know why? For me, because of my reliance on God. And there's a transformation from self-reliance to my reliance on God. Believe me, I'm not perfect with this. I am not perfect. But, you know, I don't do as many 10 steps as I used to because everything used to bother me. I'd walk in the room, somebody didn't look at me the right way. I would, you know, I had no tolerance because I was allowing other people's behaviors or what they said or what they didn't say. They didn't say hello to me. Don't bother me so much. And promise, become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily. So the ninth step, and Melanie mentioned the ninth step, and yes, my relationship with my daughter is, oh my gosh, it's amazing. And I'll tell you, throughout my years, all these years that I spent in 12-step program, I apologized to her many, many times. And what I learned is that apologies don't mean anything, first of all. I need to take action. And to only do a formal ninth step one time and let it go. She was still angry with me in years and years. And she, I believe, does have some anger with me. But I learned that I did my part. And because I was thinking, because I did my part, that I apologized and I changed my ways and I did that, that she was going to just absolutely change and become loving and kind. And actually, she has become that, but not because of my apology, because of my acceptance of the person that who she is. I kind of ran out of time to talk about, I talked a little bit about 10, 11, and 12. Oh my gosh, 11, I love spending time with God. And my 12th step, oh my gosh, let me just turn to that page. It's page 89. And that first paragraph, which practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking, for me, for compulsive eating, as intensive work with other alcohol. Okay, so now, let me tell you, I just finished with someone. She just completed 12 steps. Yay, I know she's going to start sponsoring. And whenever I finish with someone, I want to take a break. I don't want to pick up anyone else, sponsor. I want to take a break. I don't know why I always want to take a break, because I love the effects I get from sponsoring, from doing 12-step work. And I know that I need not take a break. So I need to get another sponsor. So, Melanie, I'm going to stop there. I said enough. I think I said what I was supposed to say. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. It was just this wonderful walk in with your hand through your whole journey of recovery, and it was just beautiful to watch and listen to here this morning. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to ask Anne Marie for her contact information at the conclusion of this meeting after the recording stops. So stay with us clear to the end so that you can grab that up and give her a jangle. The share ID number for today, Sunday, October 6, 2024, is 21805, 21,805, so that you can go back and listen to that again. The lines are now open, and for questions, if you're interested in asking Anne-Marie a question, please unmute your phone by pressing star 1 on your phone keypad. Offer your first name and the first letter of your last name and your state, and immediately upon asking your question, would you please remute your phone again so the line is nice and quiet? Who would like to ask a question this morning?
Lilan P. from Germany.
Somebody L, and then Lilan.
Barbara from Texas.
Is it Nancy L? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, Nancy L, okay. Yes.
Okay, and you said you were from?
Hanayeta R. From Texas.
Hanayeta.
Stephanie O. from Colorado.
Gotcha. Thanks, Stephanie from Colorado.
Barbara P.
Barbara, where are you from?
Georgia.
Got it. Things went quiet, so maybe that's our first line up there. Nancy L., when you come back, you can tell me where you're from again. I didn't catch that. Lilan from Germany, Stephanie O. from Colorado, Hanayeta from Texas, and Barbara P. from Georgia. You're up first, Nancy. Your state, please. Nancy L. There you are.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Anne-Marie. I enjoyed every minute of it, and I could relate to so much. My question to you is that when you were a little girl and you took those cookies, you felt, I forget what you said, but it sounded to me like you just felt relief and peace, and you felt good. And I was just wondering how you handle situations now. Let's say, for instance, that you go out to the mailbox tomorrow and you get something out of the mailbox and it's bad news. And that feeling comes again, that feeling that you need relief. You know, you're feeling really troubled. So how would you handle that situation? Thanks so much.
Thanks, Nancy. Yeah, the feeling that I got when I was a little girl was comfort. And if I got a bill in the mail, first, my heart usually drops to my stomach, and I think, God's got this. He has a transformation. Oh, my gosh, now that I think of it. But I just believe that God's got me. Even doing this talk, I kept thinking, God's got the words for me. It's a reliance on God now. That I didn't have before. And, you know, my daughter and her fiancé asked me to go to a football game last night, and I wasn't going to go because I didn't think I was prepared enough for this talk. And I thought, my second thought was, I got you, Anne-Marie. Like that inner voice, that God consciousness within, that's what it is. I have that. That's on page 560. God consciousness within. I have that today. And that's the steps. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Nancy L. Appreciate that. Next up is Lilan P. from Germany, followed by Stephanie. Hi, Lilan.
Hi, thanks. This is Lilan P., recovering compulsive overeater in Berlin. Thank you so much for your story, Anne-Marie. And you said that something that made a really profound difference for you was two-way prayer. And I was wondering if you could describe how you do two-way prayer, and also maybe describe it to me, describe it as you would to someone who has never done two-way prayer. So that would be great. Thanks.
Okay. And if you call me, once my contact, I'll give you a lot more information on it. So what I learned was that the in the Oxford group before the AA started did this, Dr. Bob and his wife and Bill in particular. So I write something that's bothering me. Something, how does it, my granddaughter, she's only three, if you have a grandmother or a grandparent, I kind of hope that my daughter would do certain different things. And so I give that to God now. I don't tell my daughter. That's amazing. Because before Nicolette was born and I wasn't recovered through God's grace and mercy, I would tell Kara what she needed to do all the time. That's my daughter. I tell her all the time what to do. Oh my gosh, Melanie, help me with the question if you wrote it down and I didn't write it down.
Milan, are you there again? Can you repeat?
Yeah. So I was just, you said that two-way prayer had made such a difference in recovery.
Right.
I was asking.
Right.
I
remember now. Oh, my gosh. I kind of got distracted. I'm sorry.
Great. Thank you.
No
so,
worries.
No worries.
Okay. So I'll write something about what I'm seeing, what I'm observing, my perception, and asking God to help me with it. Like, how can I turn this around? And then I sit for 20 minutes. I actually do this with a prayer partner. And we sit quietly for 20 minutes. And during that 20 minutes, I do different things. Sometimes I have some books that I listen to. Sometimes I listen to, I have some quiet time with, and I learn wonderful sponsor. I don't do it all the time, but then light of God and exhale darkness itself. And I sit. And then once that time is over, sometimes I get something from the reading that I read or a book, one of the, you know, the daily or one of my books or something from music that I hear or something from the quietness. And then I was taught to, in my letter from God, a term of endearment, my sweet daughter, my loving child. And, you know, today I really believe I'm God's most special child. And I think that I wish all of us would say that to us. But I know that I'm God's most special child. So I start with a term of endearment, and it's something loving. And then I just start writing. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't have anything to do with what my love and true God was about. It's just different, you know. And today I am able to look at my daughter and am proud. I am so proud of the woman that she's come to be, and the way that she's bringing up her daughter. And it wasn't anywhere. I was in the food so much when she was growing up. So I digressed again. So I hope that helps. But please give me a call, and I'll give you some more information on it.
Thank you, Lilan P. from Germany, for your question. Stephanie O. of Colorado, your question's up now, and then Honeyetta will follow you.
Good morning. It's Bessie O. Is there another Stephanie? Is it Bessie?
I bet not.
I just want to make sure I'm the right person. Okay. Good morning.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Anne-Marie. Question, during those years, best sponsors, doing everything your sponsors told you to do, to 2020. Just curious if there are any, if there were step one issues, like things that you were clinging to in step one that you were unwilling to let go of. And I know this is two, so maybe it's a little illegal, but I also just wanted to ask about the transformation with your daughter, whether it came all at once and how you navigated that. Thanks. I'll pass.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bessie. Good to hear you. Excuse me. So, yeah, during those years, I would say between 2000 and 2020, I really did everything and gave up everything. If someone sponsor said stand on your head in the corner for 30 minutes a day, I wouldn't even ask, you know, I would just do it. But prior to that, I did not want to give up diet soda. I didn't want to get a dietitian. I knew so much. I had my own ways of doing things. I saw that these people that were recovered and had abstinence and had good life, they do things their way, and I can do things my way, and my way didn't work. So I was stubborn and obstinate before the first time I got recovered, and do want to do that. And I had an ego, you know. I think it was ego and pride. Like, I don't need stuff, you know, maybe they, but I don't need to. I can handle this. That self-reliance too. And then, no, my gosh, this transformation with my daughter was not overnight. It's been many years and lots of, acceptance. I love that chapter in the big book, Acceptance is the Answer. What a relief to accept her as she is and to see her as she is and to love her as she is. But it took a long time because I wanted her, I could see her going down the same road, the wrong path that I was going down. I wanted to change her. I wanted to redirect her. And I thought I could, because if she'd only listen to my experience and to what I said, she wouldn't have all the heartaches that she had. You know what? She had to hit her bottom like she did, and we drove together to the football game last night. Me, her, and her granddaughter, and her fiance drove up in case my granddaughter couldn't watch the whole game. But anyway, we had a lovely talk. I showed her some hairstyles that I'm thinking of doing, and I know that sounds like kind of silly, but my relationship with her is awesome now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bessie O from Colorado for your question this morning. Hanietta from Texas, you're up now for the question.
Thank you, Melanie. Thank you, Mary Anne Marie. First, I have to say I am so privileged and honored to have you as a part of my recovery team. you talked about, I wrote it down because I'm like you, I'll forget. Right. The self-reliance didn't work, you know, and I just said, how did you go from self-reliance to God-reliance? How did you, was there a time that there was that pivot that all of a sudden you realized that self-reliance is really not working and I really do need to rely on just my God? That's my question.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for
the
answer.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks, Henrietta. So, by looking back at my history and seeing what happens when it was my self-reliance, my second marriage, I thought he was my knight in shining armor, you know, and nothing was going to stop me from being married to him. And there were so many roadblocks. And I had a sponsor that said, got to look at the whole picture, Emory, look at the whole picture. I wanted to just what I wanted. So it was a history of looking back and seeing how my self-reliance and my will, like I wanted that marriage, and I was going to keep that marriage no matter what. So looking back at that, I can see. And it's not overnight, and it's not completed. Like, it's like I don't have – like total self reliance on God now. I slip back into things that should be done my way. So it's not like I flipped a coin. Like, it's not, I mean, it's a transformation, but it's an ongoing transformation, if that makes any sense. And so I still have those self-reliant moments. I recognize them now. That's the difference. There's a transformation, because before the self-reliance was, yeah, this is right. I had that delusion, the illusion that my way was tells me that, you know, look at something differently. So even with this talk, you know, I was just going to wing it, you know, and my sponsor kindly suggested that I take some notes. So then the perfectionist came out in me. So anyway, I think the answer for that is looking at my past, and the evidence is there. The evidence is there that self-reliance doesn't work.
Thank you very much, Hannah, for your question this morning. Next up is Barbara P. from Georgia. Your question.
Hey, good morning, and thanks so much for your talk. This is Barbara P., recovered compulsive overeater in Georgia. And, gosh, Anne-Marie, I think what I heard you say is that fear isn't the defect, it's the self-reliance. And I think that nails it for me. The question is really, in the moment, when you get in big fear, I don't know, something's coming at you, do you have any techniques to remember, whoa, wait, rely on God, or does it just happen for you now? Oh, and
yeah,
Melanie, I think there was a Stephanie R. in the order. I think that's what happened with Bethy. Oh, anyway, I think Stephanie R. was in there. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
No, thanks, Barbara. You're so thoughtful. Thank you. Appreciate that. I think about Stephanie. There's a Stephanie out there. So anyway, excuse me. My mind just went blank. Barbara P., please unmute and tell me the question again. I don't know why my mind just went blank.
Sure. Just what do you do in the moment when you get the big fear? How do you remember?
Oh, that's right.
Oop,
that's
I'm
right.
going
that's
to self-reliance.
Right.
Yeah. I
okay.
do it all the
okay.
time. So what do you
yeah.
do to remember?
Yeah. Sometimes I just start thinking. I go down that road where a thought comes into my head. Dramatic fear. My granddaughter getting kidnapped, and then it rolls down, and I realize that I'm in it. I think that's what it is. I realize that I'm in it, and I say, okay, God, please take this away from me. And then it'll come back, and it's like, God, please take this away from me. And then I can call someone and say, this is what I've just been thinking. You know, what I'm thinking, I know it's ridiculous. Saying something out loud to someone else helps me tremendously. Because I believe that I call this Satan, and it's always working around, trying to get at me. And those thoughts come from, it doesn't come from God. Those thoughts don't come from that God. They're not God thoughts. So I recognize it, and I don't stay in it. I ask for help. I either call someone. If it continues, I call someone and I talk to someone and just say, these are the thoughts that are going on in my head. But the recognition that they are just obscene thoughts has come. So I hope that helps.
Thank you very much, Barbara P., for your question this morning. And in the idea that Barbara gave us, is there Stephanie out there that was interested in asking a question this morning? Stephanie R., perhaps? I'm going to take that as possibly no for today. Hey, you know what? We do have time for, looks like, one, maybe two more questions. If you have a burning desire, would you like to press star one and unmute and give us your name and your state? Anyone with a burning desire this morning?
Hi, this is Michelle J. from Texas.
Hi, Michelle. Let's take your question. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, hi. I'm a compulsive overeater. Thank you so much, Anne-Marie. Thank you, Melanie, always. Anne-Marie, gosh, that was so moving. I wanted to ask about your, when you said you got a definition for tolerance and that really helped change your way of looking at that. Can you speak on that, please?
Yes, thank you. So I have it written in my book. And it's on page, my notes on page 67. But what I used to understand tolerance was that I have to put up with other people's behavior. And so what I have here is the tolerance, a diminished sensitivity to the things that disturb me. That's what it is. A diminished sensitivity for things that disturb me. So I'm tolerant of let me see. Somebody's calling me. I'm not gonna just ignore it. So I'm tolerant of other people. Oh, politics. If someone says something to me that is that I don't like, I don't always jump on them. I remember this one time I did jump on someone and expressed my thought, and I was really upset at myself for doing that. But for the most part, it doesn't bother me. I'm not thinking about it all day. If someone, I go into a meeting and someone doesn't look at me, I don't automatically think it's about me. You know, that selfish self-centeredness has diminished, or if, especially at my AA meeting, things don't always run the way that I want them to run, I can think, it's okay, it's running the way it's supposed to. And I remember quite a few years back, my home AA group decided to go around the room and, rather than people just raise a hand when they're ready, that they go around the room. And I could not sit there. I could not tolerate people because, I wanted to speak, and I knew I was going to run out of time. Or somebody else. So anyway, I wasn't able to sit there. But now, I can tolerate it. It doesn't bother me. So that's what it is. I'm glad I remembered. I wrote down that that definition. Here's another one. To be open-minded, to not be sensitive. That's another good way of being tolerant. It's just to be open-minded. People are not always going to be like me. People have differences. Judgment I have judgment, and that's not part of who God wants me to be. And so judgment really is being intolerant of somebody else is doing and not doing it the way that I want them to do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question, Michelle J. I think we have time for one more quick one. Anybody else have a burning desire? One more quick question. I think all minds are clear this morning. Doing such a good job. Oh, hello. Yes.
Hi, this is Kat G from California.
Okay, Kat, you have a question this morning. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, I sure do. Anne-Marie, that was great. I can't wait to elaborate on that later. But my question is on the essentials of recovery that you talked about. If you could just point out again real quick where that is, and this may take longer than you have, in the doctor's opinion, he said it was there and in Appendix 2 and in Bill's story.
Yes, and I was being a little perfectionist, so I wrote everything down. So thanks, Kat. Good to hear you. So in the doctor's opinion on Roman numeral 29, which is XXIX, I think that's at the bottom of the page. Now I took my bookmark out there. Let me look for that. On page, in Bill's story, I know on Bill's story, the last sentence on page 13, and then also in the appendix 2 on page 568, that is I'm looking at something else. Okay. On page 568, the last paragraph, I think it's almost like the last sentence. It talks about WHO, willingness, honesty, and openness are the essentials. I believe that's what it says. And then on in the doctor's opinion, it's in like the middle of the page. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. It's the paragraph that starts with faced with the problems. I think those were the three that I mentioned.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks, Kat. Yeah, you betcha. Thanks, Kat, for your question. And that'll be the last question for today. And you made it through a beautiful, beautiful session this morning. You've offered so much of yourself this morning, and I'm just grateful for that. And we're getting close to the time of closing. So we will close within our usual fashion here at A Vision for You by reading page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.